The next case on the court's oral argument docket is Las Vegas Motor Coach Resort Owners Association versus Stephen Boer, Kathleen Boer, and Nora Gisano. Cases 65546 and 66036. Ready to go, Mr. Larson?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Good morning, court and counsel, please. My name is Brent Larson. I'm with the law firm of Diener, Malin, Larson, and Chula. I'm here representing the HOA, Las Vegas Motor Coach, who was the successful bidder at an HOA lien foreclosure sale. We have filed this appeal to seek a reversal of the district court's granting of summary judgment to the lender and the prior owner involving the super priority lien. That ruling was made prior to this court's decision in the SFR case, and we believe that the SFR decision mandates a reversal of that summary judgment, and that this court should, all one of the things we're seeking is this court give instructions to the district court to grant the HOA's counter motion for summary judgment based on the SFR case. Now, part of the relief we're asking for is an explanation as to who gets any bid proceeds. We bid the full amount of the HOA lien at the time of the sale. And there is the possibility, at least prior to SFR, when a lot of unsettled issues, that if we were dealing with one lien, we foreclose on the entire lien, we bid on the entire lien, which the SFR case said we were entitled to, then the question is, does the lender, are they entitled to any portion of those bid proceeds that are in excess of the super bid amount? We say that they are not. Based on NRS 116-1164, 3C, I believe, is what is called the waterfall statute. That statute dictates how bid proceeds are allocated after the sale. And it says that the HOA gets the full satisfaction of their lien, and therefore we would be entitled to retain the entire bid proceeds. And in that case, we would agree that the claim against the prior owner, Chisano, should be dismissed. If the lender, in this case the Boers, if they could claim any portion of those proceeds, that would still leave a deficiency remaining unpaid by the owner. Now, we submit that this court should order the district court to grant summary judgment in our case based on the SFR case. All of the conclusions of law that the district court reached, we, as we point out in our opening brief, are all nullified or eliminated or found to be incorrect based on the SFR case. But now the lender, in this case, in their answering brief, is saying, well, notwithstanding SFR, there's other reasons to affirm the summary judgment. So they make the argument that they made a tender. And the argument of a tender is a clear misrepresentation of the record. The tender that they talk about is quoted at page 5 of our reply brief. And what they're talking about there is a question. It was not a tender. They merely asked the question. They start out by saying, will the association accept approximately $16,000 if you, and I emphasize the word if, you will cancel all the foreclosure proceedings? This court clearly articulated what a tender is in the United International case versus United Mortgage. It's cited in our reply brief. A tender requires two things. Two, delivery of the payment. The United Mortgage case spoke about a landlord-tenant problem. They said the tenant had to deliver to the landlord possession of the money so that he could take it unconditionally. In this case, all we have is a question, and at best, it's an offer of compromise. They asked the question in an attempt to negotiate. That's all that was. So there was clearly no tender. So the idea that the amount of the conditional offer was required my client to take less or take an amount of money that is more than $10,000 less than what they're owed, clearly my client acted in good faith and within its rights to reject the offer. That fact that it was would have been enough to satisfy the super priority portion of the lien is a non-starter. Because there's
wait a second. Was this my understanding of this case is that the district court ruled against you primarily on the basis of a pre-SFR reading of Chapter 116, correct?
Correct.
Did the district court get into this tender argument that is now being made to sustain the result reached in district court?
Not in the way it's presented to this court, no. The court, they made the argument, they used the word tender when they referred to this offer. The court's findings characterized it as a tender. We argued that it can't be considered a tender.
Did you make that argument in the district court?
Yes.
That it cannot be considered a tender?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Continue. I'm sorry to...
It's I believe it's clear in the transcript and the briefs that...
Okay. Because the court's findings don't get to it at all.
No, they don't. They don't address the fine points of what we're talking about here today. The district court never addressed those fine points. The fine point being that you can't call it a tender, and this is really an issue of law. You can't call a conditional offer a tender when there's conditions attached and the money isn't delivered. They also argue, or the lenders argue, that our notices were deficient. Allegedly deficient. They admit they got the notices. We've cited the Schilling v. Cap 1 case that says, in the context of a guarantor who never actually received the required statutory notice, but indeed had actual notice of a foreclosure, this court ruled against the guarantor's argument of deficient notice by saying if you have actual notice, your rights are complied with. In this case, at page 5 of their answering brief, they admit they received the actual notice.
Did the notice contain the appropriate super priority amount, or did it contain a full lien amount, if any?
The notice at that time was in, I believe, late 2011 or early 2012. It contained the full amount of the lien. It did not delineate the difference between the super priority or the sub priority amount. And according to this court's decision in SFR, that's a perfectly proper way to send out the notices. It may not be under the current statute, but the current statute does not apply to the facts of this case. I hope that answers your question.
Not really, but go ahead.
All right. Anyway, it provided the full amount of the lien. They bid the full amount of the lien. In SFR, this court said, you can bid the full amount. And the argument that they're making is the same argument that the bank made in the SFR case, that they should have been given a separate notice of the super priority amount, and this court rejected that argument. What they're now arguing is they even admit that the statute was facially complied with. Then they say, the lender says, well, if it's facially complied with, that in and of itself is not sufficient to comply with due process. But this due process argument was not asserted in the district court proceedings. What they're now saying is the notice itself referred to the CC&Rs, and the notice said that the buyer would take title without covenant or warranty. But the fact that the notice refers to the CC&Rs doesn't make the notice defective. Again, it's facially complied with. The notice in the CC&Rs, or notice reference to the CC&Rs, is merely a reference that it's the CC&Rs that establishes the power of sale to begin with, that the HOA can exercise. This court, again, in SFR, and they're trying to rehear the SFR case. This court made it very clear in SFR that just because CC&Rs contain a mortgage subordination clause, that clause is still preempted by our Nevada statutory provisions in Chapter 116. You'd have to retreat from SFR to accept the lender's argument. Now, they also argue, well, it's without warranty. And that what they're really trying to say is the notice says that the buyer at the sale would take subject to the first deed of trust. But the notice contains no such language. They're essentially asking this court to rewrite the notice. The notice that says it's without warranty complies with NRS 116-31164, I believe it's sub or 3A, that specifically tells the buyer at an HOA sale, you're buying without warranty. So you're buying with the risk of whether the first deed of trust still maintains its security interest. SFR clearly has said that it can eliminate, extinguish the first trust deed security interest. So, given those parameters of what they claim is a deficient notice, they haven't given any reason, any viable reason, why summary judgment shouldn't be directed in my client's favor on a remand from this court. They cite cases dealing with this facial argument, dealing with state court action. They cite the probate case, which is Kotowski, and they cite a sheriff's sale case with Schwartz. Those are two cases where the judiciary branch of the government is the state actor, and as a consequence, a state actor could involve due process rights. But even due process rights don't require that the aggrieved party have actual notice of the foreclosure sale. It only requires that they be given notice. In this case, there is actual notice. And a private foreclosure sale, as the Ninth Circuit recognized in the Shalimar v. Diener case, does not involve a state actor. And as a consequence, there is no due process issue. And even so, it was not raised below, and therefore it's been waived.
Would you agree that if we were to uphold the foreclosure sale, that to the extent your credit bid exceeded the amount of the super priority lien, the amount of that excess would have to go to the Boerhers, who were the holders of the first deed of trust?
I recognize that's a possibility, and that's the very reason the Chassano's prior owner was brought into this case. If this court makes that ruling, then Chassano would still owe a deficiency. We don't believe that's the correct ruling to make because we think that 31164-3C specifically provides the statutory allocation of the proceeds, and that statute is not ambiguous, and that statute should be followed so that my client, the HOA, receives the entirety of the proceeds. In that case, then the prior owner, claims against the prior owner should be properly dismissed.
I just have one question. You indicated that there was a defect in the tender in this case. You don't consider a tender that was made because the question was couched as, will the association terminate the foreclosure if Nora pays all the fees, correct?
I contend that's nothing more than a question of making an offer of compromise.
Okay, and then there were email exchanges that went on to say if they would accept it, she was prepared to send over the runner with the that amount right away.
Again, it was an offer of compromise. They were told they'd have to go to the board. By the time the board was canvassed, they said no.
Okay, but that was the 15, correct me if I'm wrong, the 15,939 was the super priority amount.
No. Okay. The super priority amount was less than that, in the $3,500 range. But the point is, for the HOA to accept that amount of money, the question is, will you cancel the foreclosure?
Okay.
And we have the right the next day to proceed with the foreclosure.
Well, but what is it that? What about the email that said from LVMC, Ms. Chisano, thank you for your payment in full? What is that referring to?
Well, it was a statement I submit was made in jest. That was never part of the discussions in the district court. 7 minutes later, the same person writes and says, okay, we've heard from the board that they've rejected your offer.
I mean, it goes 3:26 p.m. I'm prepared to send you 15,000. I'll send the runner over. LVMC answer says, thank you for your payment in full. And then it has something about profanity around children.
Right. All right, but nothing in this case suggests that there was an offer that was accepted and that no, there's no pleading in this case, there's no counterclaim in this case.
Why isn't that an issue of fact for the district court?
Because it's not in the pleadings. They never made the argument that they made an offer that my client accepted. 7 minutes later, and it's also clear that it requires board acceptance. This is one person talking. 7 minutes later, he responds and says...
Well, that's looking at it as a settlement, but a tender doesn't require board acceptance. I mean, I can say, here's a certified cashier's check for $15,000. I ask you to take it. You don't have any control over that as a tender.
That's true, but that didn't happen here. They never delivered possession of the check they talked about.
Okay.
Any time I have left, I'd like to reserve for rebuttal.
It's limited.
8 seconds.
You might.
8 seconds.
Eight seconds.
Our tender is being generous. I'm just kidding you. Okay. Go ahead.
Justice, yes. Justices, may it please the court. Maria Katz, Tammy Cowden, and Phil Hymanson, on behalf of respondents and cross appellants Nora Trezano and Stephen and Kathleen Boer. Justices, this case is very different from all of the other super priority lien cases this court is looking at the moment. It's different from SFR. It's different from the case heard this morning. It's different from the Park v. Wells Fargo case the court heard argument on in October. To begin with, the parties are different here. In this case, you don't have a bona fide purchaser at an HOA sale versus a financial institution. What we have is an HOA on the one hand, and a unit owner on the other hand, and the two individuals that sold the unit owner the property. They were the former owners, Mr. and Mrs. Boer, were the former owners of this property. They sold it to Ms. Trezano and financed the sale, taking a deed of trust on the property. The parties are different. The other thing that's different is the record here. In SFR, the court was limited to reviewing a motion to dismiss record. Same in Park v. Wells Fargo. In this case, we have a summary judgment record, which allows us to see what exactly the notice given here was. And we can analyze that. Counsel's already discussed the contents of the notice. And when you look at the contents of the notice, what the court needs to ask is that notice reasonably calculated to provide actual notice? That's what the requirement is here. If you look at the notice, it's clear on its face that it's misleading. And that's because the notice of foreclosure cites to the association's CC&Rs. It says this foreclosure is of a lien pursuant to the association's CC&Rs. Now, the CC&Rs have a mortgage savings clause, and that they say that an association lien under the CC&Rs can never take priority over a first deed of trust. That the association's foreclosure that they're noticing the respondents of could never extinguish the Boer's deed of trust. That's the notice they decided to give. That was completely within their control as to what notice they're going to give, and that's what they tell. Now, the association argues that SFR has addressed the CC&R issues, and it said that this court said, no, CC&Rs cannot subordinate a lien given to the association via Chapter 116. And we concede that. This court has ruled that CC&Rs cannot subordinate the lien. But what this court didn't reach in SFR is what notice was given. And when you have notice that's misleading, that specifically states that the lien being foreclosed on is a lien junior to the deed of trust holders here, that does not afford actual notice. There's a record here. The court can reach that conclusion. The association also argues they weren't required to provide actual notice because they're not a state actor. So they don't need to comply with due process requirements for notice. The cases they cite, however, California case law addressing trustee sales, and the California courts have held, well, no, this is just the enforcement of a private contract. There's no state action here. I'd like to note, first of all, that counsel has conceded that the courts are state actors. And in this case, we have a quiet title action involving the courts. But what we also have is not the enforcement of a contract between the parties, because the contract between the parties here is the CC&Rs that have this subordination clause. So that's not what the association is asking to be enforced. They're not asking for the contract to be enforced. What they're asking to be enforced is 116 through 116's super priority provision. Now, that's state action, too, when the legislature enacted that provision that overrided the party's contract here. So there is state action here as well.
Counsel, can you tell me why your client didn't ask for an injunction against this sale prior to it taking place to litigate these exact issues? You're laying out the notice and whether it's misleading and all that, not after the fact, but before the fact.
Yes, Justice. Well, they were looking at what the notices were given, and they were never put on notice fairly that the association was trying to foreclose on a lien that was super to the board.
So they felt that the foreclosure was not going to affect their first deed of trust on the property.
Right, and that's because of the notice that they received. And not only the notice that they received, but the association's conduct throughout the entire proceedings evidenced an intent to foreclose on a lien that was junior to the board's deed of trust.
Because it referenced the CCNRs.
Well, there's other conduct as well. So, yes, there's the CCNRs that were provided in the notice. But then if we get to the tender issue. So the day before the foreclosure proceeding, Ms. Chisano, and it's already been discussed a little bit, makes a tender for all of the past due monthly assessments, all of the outstanding special assessments, plus costs, plus foreclosure
costs. But did she tender? His point is there was never a check, never unconditional funds delivered, offered.
And I would argue that's a distinction without a difference, because in this day and age, you know, digital age, when you send an email saying I'm prepared to send my runner over with the check, it's essentially knocking at the door and having the door shut in your face. So the tender was made here. It was, and to address the point that it was a conditional tender.
I'm less concerned about the conditional tender than I am about the failure to tender an actual certified check or to send the runner with the certified check. I mean, I recognize it's a bit of an Alphonse and Gaston sort of routine, but that would have been a perfect tender.
And perhaps that would have been the step that would make it even more certain. However, I think it is certain enough with the record, and it's clear the record is before the court, what the communication was specifically, that Ms. Chisano is prepared to tender the check, to send a runner with the check, if the association, and just to address the conditional part, if the association will terminate the foreclosure proceedings. Now, counsel argues this is a conditional tender to satisfy the debt. But that doesn't anywhere appear in the offer name, in the tender. And that's because it wasn't a conditional offer. Ms. Chisano was not saying, association, cancel the debt. I don't owe any more debt than what I'm willing to pay. All it said was, if the association terminates the foreclosure proceedings.
Doesn't the word if imply that what you're saying wasn't present? I mean, a tender is, here's my check. Something else following it, here's my check, but I'm going to keep it until you do something else, makes it something very different, does it not?
I don't think in this context it does justice. And that's because the amount that was being tendered was far and above what the super priority portion of this lien was. Now, counsels admitted they'd never provided notice that they were foreclosing on a super priority lien, nor did they provide the amount of the super priority lien. And that leaves a little ambiguity as to how you pay off that super priority portion of the lien. When the tender was made on the condition if the foreclosure proceedings are terminated, that includes the super priority portion of the lien being terminated. And this tender was for far and above what the super priority portion would have amounted to. In this case, approximately $3,000. The tender is for about five times that amount.
Do you have cases? I didn't see them in your brief, and maybe I didn't read them all, and probably didn't, but that established this as a sufficient tender to send an email saying I'll send a runner with a check.
I don't believe we did brief that, because I do think, and I hope I'm not misleading the court on this, I don't think that tender issue, the qualm with it not being an actual check handed over,
yes.
I don't believe that was raised.
Because he was mainly arguing it's conditional, and that was the area of dispute then?
Well,
as you
say,
it was conceded to be a tender.
Well, I don't think that the specifics of his argument were made below to the district court. So the district court was relying in part on...
Well, your brief says, here it is undisputed that the HOA received a tender of payment in the amount of $15,000 and change, which the HOA's president referred to as payment in full, and you cite a record, cite for that. Is that true, that it was undisputed that the HOA received a tender of payment in full?
My recollection of the record below is that they did not make a qualm about the sufficiency of the tender. What was argued below is that it wasn't the Boers that made that tender.
Okay.
And to address the tender and also an issue that kind of came before the court in the hearing before, whether or not the HOA has an obligation to accept payment of the super priority portion of the lien, even though the full amount of the lien is not being offered. And I submit that it absolutely does have that obligation to accept payment of the super priority portion of the lien, and that is inherent in the statutory scheme here.
What is your response to counsel's argument today that a tender under our jurisprudence, at least in the context of landlord-tenant, compels the delivery of the funds?
And if I read that case correctly, in that case there was, the facts were that the money was handed over, but that was not a point that was relied upon in reaching the court's conclusion in that case.
So your view is that issue has not been addressed or answered by this court as to what is legally a sufficient tender?
I believe that is correct.
Do you believe that the question about tender is an issue of law or a mixed question?
In this case, I believe that there is a mixed question as to what, especially given the communications between the parties here, mm-hmm. that there are factual issues that would preclude summary judgment in the association's favor here. However, I don't think that there is a factual issue that precludes summary judgment or the court affirming the district court's grant of summary judgment to the respondents.
On the question of tender, you acknowledge it's a mixed question, so summary judgment's appropriate for you but not for them? Not sure I follow that reasoning.
Well, I misspoke. But the other reasons in the record for affirming the law.
I mean, you're arguing for different reasons you're entitled to summary judgment, and that relates to the notice provisions reference to the CC&Rs.
Correct, and then also the credit bid, which frustrated any attempt by the Boers to pay off just the super priority portion of the lien, which again...
But you seem to acknowledge that this whole question about tender is a mixed question of law and fact.
Yes, and I would
so,
acknowledge that.
And was not addressed by the district court.
Correct.
Okay.
But there must be a way for the unit owner and the deed of trust holder to make a payment of just the super priority portion, and the HOA must be obligated to accept that super priority portion, because if it doesn't, what the HOA effectively does is elevate its entire lien to a super priority position over the deed of trust holder. And that's clearly at odds with what the statutory scheme is, because if you look at the statute, the plain language, the legislature made the determination that, no, the HOA's lien is junior to the deed of trust holders.
So you're asking us to write law around, let me be clear, to write law around what the legislature has just provided in favor of the Homeowners Association, correct?
I might misunderstand your question slightly. The amendments to the statute, mm-hmm. My argument is just that the HOA has to accept the super priority portion of lien.
On what authority?
On the statutory scheme here. Because if the HOA rejects a tender of the super priority portion of the lien and says, no, we only have to accept...
Putting
the issue of tender aside, but if assuming a proper tender is made of the super priority portion, the statutory scheme requires the HOA to accept that. Because if it does not, what it in effect does is elevate the HOA's entire lien into a super priority position, because the only way to protect the first deed of trust in that case would be to pay the entire lien. And that is
matter that the tender came from the current homeowner rather than the holder of the first deed of trust?
I don't think that matters, Your Honor, and that's because the...
Why? Because I could see an argument that it would, in that the holder of the first deed of trust can tender the amount of the super priority, hypothetically, extinguish that, wipe out the sale as to that holder of the first deed of trust. But if the owner wants to make a tender of more than the first deed of trust, or more than the super priority piece, let's say the super priority is $5,000 and the homeowner tenders 10 or 15, the HOA, does it have to accept the sub-priority piece of the tender, even if there's a first deed of trust, because it's possible that the HOA doesn't know what the first deed of trust secures, and it might get some of that money, and it wants to get the whole of it from the homeowner, including the sub-priority piece. Do you follow the question? Does it matter who makes the tender?
I don't think it matters who makes the tender because the unit owner here has, in all of these cases really, has just as much standing to make the tender of just the super priority portion, and that's because the deed of trust is securing that owner's debt. So they have an interest in protecting their mortgage holder.
But if the homeowner doesn't tender the full amount, the foreclosure sale doesn't stop.
Correct, but it would proceed only
if
the
homeowner is still liable for the full amount, aren't they?
Yes, but the foreclosure proceeding as to the super priority portion must be terminated, and only the sub-priority piece can go forward.
But the foreclosure sale still goes forward as to the homeowner.
That's true, because if paying off the super priority portion of the lien, but it does protect the deed of trust holder, which
yes.
The benefit also inures to the homeowner, because the debt is securing it, the deed is securing their debt. But the homeowner, as well as the first deed of trust holder, has the absolute ability to make a tender of the super priority piece, and that HOA is obligated to accept that, because if it does not, what it does is elevate the entire lien to a position above the first deed of trust.
It won't stop the foreclosure sale. If the foreclosure sale has been noticed on the super and the sub-priority pieces both, somebody, the homeowner comes along and tenders just the super priority piece, the $5,000 in my previous example, the sale would still proceed as to the sub-priority piece, correct?
That is true. However, in this case, when we look at what Nora's email said, where she was tendering almost $17,000.
And profanity, evidently.
She, admittedly, and they bring this up in their briefing, if I may just finish the point,
yes,
that Nora never mentions the super priority piece, never mentions that this is a payoff of the super priority piece. But what's so critical is that no notice the HOA ever sent to Nora either mentioned the super priority piece.
Okay, fair enough.
Thank you.
Can I just make it 2 seconds?
No, you can go 2 minutes, sir. I assume you'll accept my tender.
Thank you. Certainly.
It was unconditional, clearly.
Right. That's even better. There's an important set of facts that is left out of Ms. Katz's argument. Number one is the lender sat on the sidelines. And they weren't even in the arena, so to speak. They did nothing to protect themselves. There is no affidavit, no evidence of any kind that they offered to show that they were misled by these notices. There is nothing to suggest that the lender ever asked for the amount of the payoff of the first lien. That is very different from the previous case that was heard just before this case. So the lender, they're asking that the lender be relieved of their negligence in not paying attention to protect their security interest. And this court in SFR specifically addressed what, assuming the allegations in the complaint in SFR were true, then they have no one to blame but themselves. And as this court pointed out, they could have protected themselves. And in this, what makes this case even stronger than SFR is that this is a summary judgment motion by both sides. And the record is very clear. They admit they received the notices. It's admitted at page 5 of their brief that both the lender and the owner received those notices. And there is nothing in this record that says that the lender did anything thereafter to protect their position. Of course, we acknowledge that they're entitled to due process when you have a state actor. But what we're talking about here is, until this lawsuit was filed, there was no state actor. Just because this court or the district court is a state actor after the proceedings, we're talking about pre-litigation activity. There was no state actor. But in any case, due process requires that all attempts be made to give notice. That not only happened, they did receive the notice, and thank you for your attention.
Any questions of counsel? All right. Thank you very much for your excellent arguments this morning, and the case will stand submitted.